Hi, this is Nancy Perozzo, and doing the second interview with Bill Skrepichuk at his home on McGregor Avenue in Thunder Bay. The date is January 12th, 2024. Today's session, we are going to be starting with looking at some of the family connections that Bill has to the grain industry. And because those family connections overlap with a fellow by the name of John Andrews, who is quite prominent in the grain industry in Thunder Bay, he will also make comments related to his memories, usually via his father, about Mr. Andrews. Okay, Bill, over to you.
Very good. Okay, well, thanks for the opportunity to tell a few family stories and also to talk about Mr. Andrews. Very, very honorable man and a great industrialist for our area. So, backing up and talking about my family history, my grandfather, Mitran and Antoniou, came to this country a couple of times, actually, in the early 1900s, and then again in the mid-1920s, and eventually got a job working for the CPR in 1928 at a section called McMorran. This is in southwest Saskatchewan, near the Eston, Saskatchewan area, and that's just west of Rosetown. He became a section man there, and one of the opportunities for working on the railroad at the time was you could bring your family over from Europe, and they would give you a quarter section of land. This is very similar to the story of many, many hundreds of people that came from Europe as noble, honest workers and occupiers of the land. CPR was giving out quarter sections. Now, in 1929... as a result of that, my mother and her siblings, two other sisters and a brother came and were brought over, and passage paid, came in through Quebec City and across on the CPR to into Saskatchewan, were picked up, as I understand, from Moose Jaw in an old buggy, and eventually got to McMorran, Saskatchewan. And my grandfather, working on the section, wintertime, summertime, eventually became ill and came down with tuberculosis. And in 1930, in June, he passed away. So they had just come to the country and were living out in the prairies, this is bald prairie out there for sure, and with this quarter section of land that needed to be broken and worked and stones removed and all the things associated with that. So the grain was obviously the reason they were here. If my grandmother would have had her way, she would have taken everybody back to Europe at the time, but what had happened is there was an insurance policy that for a year, I guess, that had expired, and therefore they were stuck. They had to stay on the land and make the best of it. So as a result of that, my mother, who was the eldest, because she was, 10 or 11 at the time, she pitched right in. It was expected to work like a man right from the beginning. And even though going to school, it's that going to school 2 or 3 miles on the horse back and forth every day, etc., was necessary, but working on the land was the key thing. So the grain crops in back in the 30s were, after breaking and putting, obviously neighbors helped, were very, very bountiful for the first couple of years until the Dust Bowl hit and the 30s kicked in, and grain became very, very hard to make a crop out of these things. But they had to build, my mother remembers, the threshing gangs and the cooking for the threshing people and stooking for drying, etc., and she having to build a granary by herself prehand to house this grain, all this kind of stuff. So grain is definitely in the family blood from the perspective of sustenance and for sustaining the families. So after, from 1929 until 1939, my mother persisted on the land, obviously with her siblings and my uncle, but all being younger, she was expected to do the lion's share of the work, and she did. But then my grandmother took sick and died again after 10 years, and so therefore it was left nobody on the land, no family on the land, no connection. As it turned out, she moved into a town, abandoned the land at this point, well, actually rented the land out, and then eventually came to the city, and eventually Saskatoon, through Rosetown first, then Saskatoon, and then when the war was on, came to Thunder Bay as Rosie the Riveter here for Kankar, and then on and on it goes. So, and met my father, I guess it was 46, and now my father had come from Ukraine. My other mother, the other family, my mother's family, came from southeastern Poland, Carpathians, all Galicia at the time, for sure. And my father, who actually was following previously his father, my grandfather and his brothers, had come here in the early 1900s and had worked and were trapped by the First World War. And eventually, they helped build things here at the time, the Jackknife Bridge, various other things, and trapped by the war, and eventually went back after the war. My father was sent in 1929 to come to Thunder Bay, and came in the spring of Thunder Bay here. Coincidentally, my mother actually had, unbeknownst, had come 29 to Saskatchewan. However, my father worked various jobs, all through labor jobs. Young, he came at night. He was 19 years old, so therefore strong and agile. Worked all kinds of jobs, and eventually ended up in the grain elevators, pool, what they call Pool 2 at the time, as kind of just a laborer, and eventually worked up to being very noticed by his hard work, and noticed by a gentleman named John Andrews, who was working for Western Grain, I guess, at the time, and was in the grain sampling and weighing department there. And at one point, John Andrews came to my father in 1937-38 and said, "Peter, I'm thinking of making a new company. I want you to come with me." And not having any real trade qualifications, my father just said, "Yes, for sure." So off he went with John Andrews. My father had been working for the day company, actually, at the time. And he went with John Andrews right from the beginning. And they both recognized each other as good, honest men. Hard-working, obviously, John's business side, and my father just installation, amongst other guys. And the company flourished through the Second World War. The primary industry had to maintain construction and runability through there, so it worked all the way through the wartime era. And again, these people were involved in Northland Machinery, is the company that John formed. They were involved with custom fitting of sheet metal workings and grain handling conveyors and systems, and which eventually came into the dust collection system in the beginning in the 1960s, etc. So my father talked a lot about that, eating, obviously, when you're in the grain industry, you eat a lot of dust and you have to work in a lot of cold weather. And especially if you're working outside, you're working a lot of high angles in the wintertime and all the rest of that stuff. So that was common outdoor work, and he went to it naturally. He was a spry and, well, middle-aged man by that time, but spry and willing to work, and willing to work along with other other contemporaries at the time. There would have been people like Joe Trimble and Bill Gillespie. There would have been Jim Pyatt. There would have been guys like Swan Anderson and Dan Blaze. And there would have been Dutchie. They called him Hutch Hank. And I can't remember his name. Dutchie was his name. He's a good layout man, my dad said. And then there was old foreman named Pearson, a supervisor who wanted my dad to when Pearson was retiring, wanted my dad to take over as a kind of a foreman on these jobs. And but my father said, I prefer just to work it out. He says I can be more valuable to you working than as a foreman. And again, that opportunity with working with John Andrews, because he was known with a deep to have a deep social conscience, honest, good, hardworking man. Obviously, he was in the business side. His brother was Charlie Andrews, who was more on the operations side. And my dad got along well with each one of these guys. And there was great the social bonding examples. For example, at Christmas, the parties for the kids. I remember those. There was always a Union party, but there was always a Northland party. And that was really, really quite something to look forward to, especially when you're young. And everybody would get turkeys. Johnny Andrews would give out turkeys for Christmas time, too, to the employees. So, again, touchstones to build a spirit, good spirit of the company. And even scholarships going forward, as John progressed and business flourished, scholarships were given out. As a matter of fact, as for worthy achievement and achievable students. And as a matter of fact, my sister was a recipient of that in 1965. She was quite proud of that, and my dad proud of it too, because she was academically inclined, not like her brother. More so, but nevertheless, my dad wasn't even kind of anxious to apply for it. But once he applied for it and she won it, he was very, very proud of it, of that achievement. So that, again, it was a company, a noble company that wanted to build a strong local presence, and obviously there was a lot of the industry here, and. They were known for good, honest work. Maybe competition might have been thinner than etc. But nevertheless, they put in their times. Testament to a guy called Joey Bamford, who has passed away now. But Joe and my dad used to work together. He was an apprentice under my father, and he said I'm talking with him a lot. He talked about my dad not being afraid of heights. And he had powerful hands. He was just not a big man, but he had powerful hands and could almost cut quarter plate by iron plate by hand type of thing, and punching. But again, wintertime work, and Joe Bamford and my dad on outside of a spout hanging from a ladder at 90 feet above the ground, and Joe on the inside with a dolly. This is the type of work that was done, and it was what had to be done at the time. And so that's the story of Johnny Andrews, Northland Machinery, and the workers associated with that. So, yeah, to continue on, I guess you could argue, my father survived that, not survived, but survived and thrived, I'll put it that way, from the late 1930s right through to even the 1960s, retired and then went back. Company had already been sold, but he went back, and all he said, I want to do is work. I need something to do, and he wanted to pay him too much money. He said, I don't want the money. Well, you take the money, but it was mostly the work that intrigued him or was his forte in life.
Who was the company sold to?
Company Westfield? No, not Westfield Roscoe. I think it was. Oh, the name is not Bisco. No, these were just.
It's not that
Zaddy. I think Zaddy Sheet Metal was one of the companies that eventually took it over, and the legacy after Northland I should know. I don't have it instantly here for
no,
you.
No, that's so easy enough to find out.
Yeah.
Was it sold because business decreased, or was it sold because Mr. Andrews was no longer heading up the company?
No, I think that they had a number of products that they were working with. They had a belting line that came in, because that was been conveying, belt conveying in the dust handling system. They had a line on various dust cleaners, and I don't believe it would have been sold due to Johnny Andrews exiting the business. I think Charlie Andrews was who the company went to after that, and maybe it was a result of them aging out of the system, probably. Yeah. And as a result of that, this would have been a viable company with a number of good product lines, and was quickly usurped by the other industries. And to a point, I guess you could say that the early sheet metal work and construction was already past. And to be honest, that work required a lot of custom-made parts, because the drawings, the ability to draw, not draw the mechanical internals and the fits of various chutes and things like that, had to be all rather custom-made, so it was all fill-fit, versus the elevator itself being the construction of the monolith. That would have been a large contract, single purpose, but the refits inside would have been custom. Let me say it that way. So there were others that filled in the blanks, and possibly came from Vancouver, the West Coast. There was a lot of crossing between West Coast and Winnipeg and Thunder Bay with the grain industry of mechanical people who could do work.
Speaking of that, that would have been the time when they had started doing the major buildings out on the West Coast. So was Northland Machinery involved because of their expertise developed here in Thunder Bay?
Short answer, yes. They did have a Vancouver office for a while. They also had, apparently in Winnipeg too, as I understand. I must admit, that's a good segue to my work. Don't go backwards with me, because again, as I'd mentioned previously, in 1980, which is a little bit further down the road, I was out working with H.A. Simons in the consulting in Vancouver, in material handling, for a number of years, and one of my job assignments was at United Grain Growers as an upgrade to United Grain Growers conveying handling systems. Were, in fact, they were, I think we put in what they called the Bueller systems. These were different types of methods for handling and transferring grain, upgrades and modernizations, things like that. But you're right, Northland did try to presence there, but because they weren't large, they didn't have a large footprint, they would have been not as competitive on large jobs. Small jobs, they could have been competitive. But again, to get plant and people to be able to work would have been it would have been a bit of a struggle, maybe is one way to put it. And in Vancouver, there was a number of places like even the Cancar operation out there, as well as ACO on the North Shore. They were well known in the industry. And then there was also competition from Seattle at the time, too, and the consultant industry, too, that way.
Did your dad have any favorite stories that he liked to tell about his time hanging off the edge of the elevators? And
well, he didn't. Not that I can remember as much as what other people tell me stories of him.
Okay.
Because he tended to be a little more on the modest side. I'll tell you, every time I pick up his sheet metal toolbox, I struggle, because these are boxes that they made themselves and had belting as a handle and all that stuff. But what these guys had to carry around was meaningful. This was not a job for complaining people who preferred to complain rather than to work. That's one way to put it, an honest way to put it. But no, he didn't. I recognize some of the materials, bits like leg bolts and things like that that happened to be in his box, small bits and pieces of things that I say, and star drills to be able to drill into concrete, and this is all by hand, where they would rotate a star drill at 90 degrees every hit to drill a hole to put a lead anchor to hammer that in so that you could put a leg bolt off of some bracket that was hanging onto this pipe, 50 feet from the grounds, and that pipe was going to be a leg that would be supplying grain to the boats and things like that, and dust collection systems too. The major pieces on top were one thing, these air handling systems, but the ductwork was nondescript, how it had to come up to the side of the elevators and go through walls, and it definitely was an appendage out the side of the elevator, because inside the elevator was plugged with other mechanical equipment, and the dust collection was large diameters so that the volumes of air would be minimized, and then for sure the big cyclones expanded to shrink the velocity, knock the dust out, and away it would go. But and again, this is not a the dust was a factor. And the dust is a factor in all of the grain handling eras. The dust that was isn't the dust that there is there now. The dust that was there before was prolific. I mean, dust was a necessary evil to handle the grain. Now they use it as a product where they can make pellets out of and sell. But there's a long trail between being a nuisance, a liability, to an asset, to put it that way.
I have a question, or just clarification. When you were talking about I think you said the term that it was by hand. Mm-hmm. Some people listening to this in 2024 would think, oh, well, you got an electric drill. It's used by hand. But I don't even think that's what you're talking about.
No electrics, nothing.
You're talking about sort of the hand crank.
The hand cranks would have been more or less for making seams, what they call Pittsburgh locks, on sheet metal, where you join and there's a pleat that you make and a groove, and then you seam that together as a strength. And then there would be all hand rivets. So the hand rivets would have been, again, this isn't a pop rivet, but this is one guy with a dolly, a metal heavy dolly on the inside, and the guy with a peening hammer on the outside. You'd pop your rivet through it, and you'd set it with a set, and then you'd hammer to make round. You'd cone it and then hammer it to make good, and that's the method of attachment.
So how would this drill work then?
So that
you're talking about, the drill drilling into the concrete.
Oh, yeah, because the drill, that's all by hand. It's a star drill is something, say, a foot long. I probably have one around. I have one around here. But anyway, it doesn't matter because I have it for my rock quarry. But the star drill is, it had kind of like a diamond edge or a carbide edge on it. It was kind of a star. And then you would start by smashing it, the end, with a hammer into the concrete wall that you're trying to fasten to. So you have to penetrate probably in about 2.5 inches anyway. And then and the diameters, you start with a small one, then you go to a bigger one. And it's all manual. And it's all Armstrong engine here, your motor, your arm. And then you set a lead anchor system in there with a wedge and a plug. And then you tap that up such that it expands and makes good. It's a wedge. And then you thread in a bolt, or not a bolt, but a screw, basically, a thick, big screw to be able to set in to hold fast. So everything is all by hand. again, and you better make sure you have all your tools with you, because going up and down was a factor. So you made sure that every time you went up there, you had enough of your tools. You had one of these metal boxes, it's up there too, hanging with you. And so you bring everything you need.
And is he, how is he suspended?
On ropes and a chair.
Like a bosun chair.
Bosun chair, yep. Yep. Off the side, there would have been a pulley system, of course, and I don't know if it would have been an air tugger, maybe a cap. Yeah, they would have had a capstan system.
What's that?
Capstan is a rotating cone, I guess you could say, and they would have had it. It would have been with air rather than electrical, and so it is an air motor, and this thing, air motor, is a gear, and it rotates this shaft like on a sailboat, a winch on a sailboat. So you make good with a couple of wraps on the rope, and up you go. you trust the guy below that it's going to work. And so, in fact, this was before a lot of the other things about scaffolding and safety. And it's not as if it was an unsafe thing. These people who worked before knew somewhat the rules. You get hurt, you come home, you don't get it paid. So there, that's the old, not the old, that was the way the country was built. I can show you images here if you want about how my guys in my quarry would do with nothing other than their wits about them. And it wasn't forced labor. This was as if you were responsible for making sure that the rope was in good shape and the endings were proper. And you never put a saddle on a dead horse. I don't know if you've ever heard that one.
No.
So what that is, when you make it end around a clevis, you there's a clamp and a shoe and two nuts. So you make sure that shoe is never on the dead end, the loose end or the short end. You make sure that the saddle
of the rope,
saddle of the holder, is on the main rope line.
Yes.
And then you tight the bolts, because as they say, you never put a saddle on a dead horse.
Okay. The unfortunate thing about a lot of this is that because of the age of the equipment and because of my lack of knowledge, I have no idea what you're talking about, but to have you say that on tape, mm-hmm. and then to marry that to a picture or to information about the
Absolutely.
Equipment that you're talking about, then it makes sense.
Of course.
But it's important to have it recorded any case.
What I bring up here is a picture of the elevators along the Cam River. This is elevator, let me see, A, that's B, and this is C. These are wooden monoliths. These were like 10-story high buildings that were all along that Cam River. These eventually were either taken down or burnt down. And these were steam plants associated. There was no dust collection systems on any of these elevators, etc. Because the idea was get the grain there, get it through them. And here's your consorts. That boat is a consort to that steamer, for example. And this boat is a consort to that. So this is how it was transported. This is the early 1900s. This happens to be this coal chute, etc. The old fort would have been right here. And the stone building would have been right here in this Cam River image here. So this was the state of affairs built in the late 1880s. And working till about 1910 or so on the wooden elevators. Now, again, that was an early, early era. And then elevator D, which is around out of this picture here, eventually becomes a... this is, again, how it was constructed. Look at the manpower and all the rest of that stuff here. This is from the island.
Can you go back to the previous one?
Yeah. Or this one here.
978.
Yeah, okay. All right. Same...
There. Oh.
Oh, you want the working one? Okay, go ahead.
The 978. Yes, because I just want to have a reference to these because they're
They're
the museum. Correct.
Yeah.
And that is that a 0.2?
Point.
41.2.
Correct. Yeah, and that's the construction of elevator B. So in fact, that B and A is shown here. Some of the early images we have in Thunder Bay is Cook standing on the top of that elevator, shooting out the Cam River and also back towards us. I can show you the reverse angle shot of this too.
Because Cook being the photographer.
Because once you have a tall building, I mean, the photographers realize, hey, this is, I can do stuff with this. And that's what happened. That's why we do have a lot of long images here of Fort William and Port Arthur too, for sure. They had the hill. We didn't, so therefore. And as you can see off in the sign, that was also a grain storage shed that was appended to A, but that's the reason why they had to make this elevator B, Cam River being here, we're looking out east this way. All of that we could talk for a long time on this. I won't. And then that, again, is from the island looking across back at it. You can see already construction up coming. Like that, hey?
Mm-hmm.
So it's we have some very good, and this is a kind of a general arrangement looking back east, going that way now. This is, again, is A, this is B, and that's C. Elevator here. They did that just to confuse. Okay, so I don't know if
so
I... Go ahead.
Before we get off track or onto another track, your dad...
Yes.
Anything else to add to his story?
Well, other than that grain industry and the Northland machinery and the sheet metal industry provided, I mean, that was family income. My mother didn't work or whatever. She did do other jobs. She had her own little sewing company and things like that. But that provided a lifestyle and for us to thrive, and it was in some ways it wasn't really walking to work, because getting to work was somewhat of a tricky thing. Now that brings up a point about how these guys would get to these elevators from the domicile area, from the place where you lived to get to where you work. You had to go across tracks or through things or under things to get to work, and everybody did, because all the work was on the river and all the people lived on the other side of the tracks. So as a result of that, you know, to get from A to B, you had to get across the tracks, which is always interesting to me. Yeah. This again is like a collage of all the elevators at the time. I'm sure you have all these pictures, yeah. And any case, so the living condition, the working condition was to do that. At the foot of Brown Street, they had to construct a steel walkover to get, you know, the CPR had to do that because. They didn't want people getting killed on hitting trains or getting run over and all the rest of that stuff. So it wasn't really an easy way to get to the elevators on the Cam River side, and even the wooden elevators you talked to, there was actually an underpass that where the guys were able to do that. That's right by the Historical Society. That little. That passage, that's how the guys got to work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had to go underneath the tracks. Otherwise, if the trains are sitting there and nobody's moving, then they got to get to work or back.
Well, and there were several tracks and very busy tracks.
Very busy tracks, especially at the yard where things started to spread. I mean, so that was always a factor in the 4M side. But other side, they were more linear because the elevators were arranged differently. They were arranged out into the lake. And so there could come along, versus here, everything was along the river. So there was always an issue about the CPR tracks. Yes, for sure.
Have you seen the article in the last Walleye magazine on the Brown Street Bridge?
No.
It's just a one-page article and talks a little bit about the CPR didn't want to build that bridge.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine.
And they didn't want to maintain it in perpetuity. So you know that story. So.
But that, again, would have facilitated on James Street the underpass. And again, we have a lot of images of that because at that spot, before the underpass was there, there was connection of, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 4 railways, maybe 5, right there. And there was a control at that spot where the trains coming from the west and the east, there would have been the CP going west. There would have been the Grand Trunk that crossed to get to the bridge. There was the PD line, the CNR line that come across like that. And then there was, if I'm not mistaken, there was a city rail or the city bus line that had to go across there too. So, I mean,
the streetcars that went out to Chippewa.
Yeah, and across the bridge. So, I mean, so it was really a traffic jam, some would say. And therefore, when the underpass was put in, it was a big relief for a whole bunch of people.
Do you know approximately when that went in?
Well, there's images in Thunder in the historical of the construction of that. And it's really quite... if you know what you're looking at, it's pretty neat.
Yes.
Yeah. And then that would have been the way that CPR could have argued, okay, you can go under the underpass and then get the elevators, but you got to kind of go a long ways to get someplace, yes.
Well, and the bridge predated the underpass, so
yes,
it was up by the time.
Yes.
And they needed to have, by that point, vehicles that could go under, and they weren't going over the Brown Street Bridge, the walkover bridge.
And take a run at it, for sure. but nevertheless, this is all part of the, there's just a few collages here of mm-hmm. these images. But back to my father. Matter of fact, a couple of things he mentioned to me when training the young fellas. He could tell right away if they were going to be able to make it or not by the fact that how they performed on the ladder, walking up the ladder. And matter of fact, a good friend of mine went to school with him. He thought he'd try the sheet metal trade and all that. And my dad was with him, and he was afraid of the elevator, of the ladder to go up.
The
young fellow was afraid to go up. My dad says, you got to go up there and do this. And
what do you mean, the ladder?
The ladder to get there.
Just a ladder.
A ladder, yeah.
How tall would that ladder have been?
I don't know. It was as tall as he had to have to get up to whatever he was doing. But it,
it didn't need to be an extremely high ladder. It would just be his work on a ladder, period.
Some would say. Yeah. So having but my dad said, no, look, when he got down, he did it, but he could see that the ladder was shaking the whole time. And my dad said, you know, I'll do it this time. But he says, you know, this may be, you may not be suited for this work, because if you get in trouble, we're both in trouble. And it's standard for in any industry like that. So, in fact, if you feel unsafe to do what you have to do, then you better not do it, because you're going to cause too much of a problem for everybody. So the fellow eventually, he went to the shop, and then eventually he said, oh, this is too hard work for me. And he got his hands cut too. The other thing about sheet metal is that you got to have, your hands are going to get cut, because you're really dealing with raw edge and sometimes rough edge. So those sheet metal guys, they never wore gloves, it seemed, but they always, I don't think I ever saw my dad with gloves necessarily, but I know that the wear and tear on the hands, yeah, there are cuts, but the cuts would heal, was significant, but powerful hands to the end, because everything was hand snips. Again, that's electric, non-electric. This is big hand snips. You know, they were what, 2 foot long, more or less, all by hand. And the night he died, he was 95 years old in January, like this is my anniversary, it's coming up soon here. He shook my hand, he hurt my hand. He was so powerful even to the end. And that night he died. So that's the story of the sheet metal and the legacy, I guess you could say, of that.
Yeah. I love those stories. You know, the little pieces like that. The technical background information, I'm hoping, will be of some use to historians as time goes on. But these personal interests, just the ladder situation, they bring something visual to you. The strong hand says so much that they're, to my mind, they're the priceless stories that come out in these interviews. Thank you. Now, where do we go? Yeah. Now, was your mother, I think the last time that we were listening to her story, she had moved here to become Rosie the Riveter.
Right.
And was there any connection, other than the farm connection of her early life, any connection to the grain industry here in Thunder Bay, your mom's side of the family?
No. I'm going to have to say nothing direct. Okay. For sure, but the legacy of her having come through the prairies, and again, that's a nice segue for me because back in the 70s, actually from 1971 to 73, every fall I would go out to Saskatchewan to harvest grain, and that was so exciting for me because there was a sense of purpose. My aunt would call my mother's sister, and they ended up with four or five sections of land out there, and she would call in August, and Bill coming, and right away my mother would just ask, and I said, when? Just tell me when. She said, we need you by next week. You got to be here. So I had my little Volkswagen, my 1971 Volkswagen Black Beetle. And she just loved the ride, and we'd go nonstop from here to Elrose, which is by Rosetown. I just drive 18 hours steady. Shouldn't have done it, but did. And take the sunrise, the sunset, get on the drive it into the field, and the tractor would be there, and right onto the swather. Leave the car, the Volksy parked right by the tractor, and. She had a big swather. She was, 22-foot bed on her, and just start making circles because you had to knock the grain down to get it ready in rows, so at least if it's down, it wouldn't all the other weather issues were minimized when the grain was down. And then you had to wait till she ripened. Sometimes it was ripe, sometimes it wasn't. And then... it'd be swathing for 3, 4, 5 days in a row. Sometimes if the crops are really heavy, I remember, oh my God, there was one down at the Holler place there it was 90 bushels to the acre barley, four row barley. And it was probably about almost 4 feet high, well, 3.5, 4 feet high. And I had to pull the table up so much so that I could cut it. And when I cut it, it would barely, the conveyor could pull it and then drop it, and it would thatch inside the stubble. Holy cow. We had a lot of trouble picking that grain up. And then the ducks were right beside in the pond, and it was a mess. But that was 90 bushels to the acre, that stuff. However, swathing. And then when she was ready, we didn't wake up early. You had to wake up whenever, you know, early meanings, early. We wake up maybe about 8:30, have a good breakfast, get to the field sometime around 9:30, maybe 10, maybe whatever, 9:30, and just get thrashing, because you couldn't thrash if it was tight, and it would be all going over the concave, so it would be just kicking it out. So you had to wait later, and then once it was going, then I had drive truck, the 5-ton truck there, and unload 2 combines on the run all the time, and then run like hell to the granaries, and then hope that the auger would work, and then start the box coming up and the slot coming out to the little bunker you'd made, and then you go and you run the auger, and then the auger doesn't work, and then you got to run and drop the box again. And, oh, it's real performance, but a lot of fun, accelerating. It was not a dull day. And then lunch, you ate 4 times a day, they'd bring all of my aunt and her sister-in-law and all the kids, they all come out to the field. You just circle the wagons, circle the equipment, and you put a tarp down in the field, and you just sit. And then they'd bring you food, and you just eat. And as soon as you, no talking, just eat, up and go. And that was that was harvesting. For I did that for how many years? 3 years, 4 years? Yeah, so that was neat. And then if it was a rainy day or whatever, something like that, nothing was happening. I used to go to the farm where my mother, the old homestead out in the prairies, and just to get a feel for, you know, the living condition, as well as, and come back. And then my uncle would tell me, he says, you know, what we harvest in a day, that was their yearly output. He said, you know, but with stooking and moving with the grain, shoveling with scoops into the granary and all that kind of stuff. So it really, really meant there was a depth of field when I was on the prairies to be able to see that. And then at nighttime, those stars and, oh my God, in that dome, you'd be driving back late at night. And say, sometimes we used to go to 2 a.m. with the lights on if the grain was moving. And then once you got tough, you shut her down, and coming back, that dome of stars, it's like when you're out in the middle of Lake Superior and you see this dome of magic, and that's what is in the prairies. It's just there. Yeah.
It's interesting. Very well told, quite poetic there, Bill. Very nice.
What I saw.
Were you ever thinking... Well, you actually drew a connection, and I think other people have drawn it a little bit, but not so directly, about the flatness, the open spaces of the prairies, and the flatness and the open spaces of the lake. Mm. Did you ever talk to your prairie family about Thunder Bay and its end of this grain trail?
Oh yeah. Oh, they were very, very knowledgeable and sensitive to it. They understood what it meant to transport and to be when they could sell the grain and all the issues around price, etc., to the farmer. Very, very, very important. Growing it is what they do, but getting it sold and getting money for it was always a challenge. And to be honest, those guys out in Eston, they were one of the first group to break away from straight Durham or Plesher Durham or two or four row barley monolithic fields and get into lentils and peas and canary seed and all the other crops that could get them a higher value.
Specialty
and
crops.
Specialty crops. And as a matter of fact, there's apparently a variety of lentils called Eston lentils, which is from that area. I mean, that's where they were experimental enough to be able to and the land probably allowed them to do that too. Like there, it wasn't as if some of their land was like poker flat, pool table flat and all the rest, but others were a little bit rolling land, and that might have lent itself well to less soil conditions, various things like that would have told them. They were very, very knowledgeable that way. They were quite the government, I guess, guys would come and talk and all the rest of that stuff, and they knew their land, they knew their soil. And they were willing to gamble on other crops other than those traditional crops. Rapeseed, for example, wasn't as profitable there because of they couldn't put in the thousands and thousands of acres to get the return, as well as the equipment for drying and for all that other stuff wasn't at hand, as well as handling it, like the rape. Stalks and like flax stalks really are tougher to massage and to break down, and therefore handling the straw from those crops is a different technique than from barley straw or from oat straw or from all the rest of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, they were experimental early, I'll put it that way, with those other crops.
We took a little bit of a pause so that we could discuss where we're going to from here, but the question I have now, Bill, for you is, because of the experience that you had on the prairies and you could, you got up close and personal with the various crops that were being produced and shipped, did that renew or create an interest in you in what was going on in the elevators, the sort of other end of the what we'll call at this point the grain trail, at least the land grain trail?
Okay, so both you and I grew up in this area of West Fork, and before even we were born, we heard the sounds of elevators and the sounds of trains on the hump, breaking up cars and various things like that. This is kind of in our blood here, whether we like it or not, and in our ears. And because of that, and whether your fathers or you knew people or your neighbors or whatever worked in the industry, etc., we know, we have a natural curiosity about all of the things that were around us. Within, you drew a circle from where you were born and I was born of about 2 miles, maybe. You would have all the sounds of industry in our area. The boats in the river, blowing the bridge, the CPR, the CNR, running across town. All of that stuff is in, whether we like it or not. So that's the natural interest that we all have in here. Whether, and you just have to scratch the surface of it, and it's there. So that's the, that's kind of a base level of inquiry. I think that the people, okay, this is a Port Arthur, Fort William thing. I think that the people in Port Arthur don't have the same appreciation because they don't have that same audible, they don't have this, they've got a different visual, and therefore it's not about them, it's about why we are so curious in our area here. We see the construction. We hear the operations. We smell the grain. I mean, when Ogilvie's was venting, you smelt that. All the rest of the stuff along the Cam River. Every time we rode in the Cam River, we'd row by these things. And so these are monoliths. Okay, so that impression has been there for a long time and deep. Visual, mental, audible, nasal. Now, having gone out to the prairies, it just enhanced the story because now I was able to touch the earth there and to do things that were meaningful in a harvest sense, the urgency of the harvest, etc. And then to see it and understand it maybe better, all the railroads, all the methods of transportation, the terminals, the operations of the terminals, always a puzzle to a point, but once you see it once, then things start to make sense to you inside the elevators. And I've gone through elevator tours that have allowed me to, you know, mechanically smart, you know, get a richer picture in your mind. And by the same token, the demise of the elevators, the fact that small elevators couldn't survive, and sometimes even large elevators had to be blown down, and that's why I, for example, when elevator D, this elevator we're looking at now, was decommissioned, and on her final days, or the final day that she still stood, I heard on the radio that it was going to be blown down. I ran there with my camera and took pictures of the workhouse being blown down, and I had no natural interest in photography that way. But it was a way of recording it as an event. And the same thing when elevator pool 6, Sass Pool, was blown down. Like, and maybe I did that as an honor to my father, but now that I think about it, because the day that that elevator got blown down, they'd already loaded it up with explosives. And so I said, you're coming with me. Where are we going? Doesn't matter. We're just going. And so I took him there, and we stood almost in the front row, And as it was being blown down, I wanted him to see that monolith, monument to the grain industry here, disappearing. Fine, because he'd worked on it. He'd been up at the top of that elevator before, doing flashing around the top, putting in the early dust collection systems, all that stuff, working on the inside for chutes and belts and all the rest of that stuff. So it was kind of a closure. It was a loop in my mind to be able to have him witness that and for me to be there. And we got pictures of it too. So that gave me comfort that it just didn't get blown down as a kind of a stunt or something along those lines. And many of the other ones too. But it was mostly those two, Elevator D here in the Cam River and Pool 6, the old Northern Canadian. Northern Elevator was caused, that was the reason why they completed the Canadian Northern Railroad in record time, and they had to run the PD line rails to get here to that for 19, I think it was 1901 crop. So that gives me a connector. We in Thunder Bay can do that because we can see the end. We can see where the wheels meet the keels, where the wheels of the rails meet the keels of the boats, and way it goes. Where it's going, who knows? If it's a Laker, you kind of figure it out. If it's a Salty, it's going to some romantic place and wherever, Moravia or whatever. Any case, okay. That's how my bloodline and my actions help me talk the way I do.
Okay, great. Obviously, a passionate connection, which serves in the interview very well. But I'm going to take you back to that day that you took your dad to Pool 6 in particular. Mm. And I want you to say a little bit about what your dad was feeling and saying. And I'd like you to relive that, 10-minute period when just before it was blown up, when it was blown up, and when literally the dust settled.
Okay, so
how was your dad feeling?
My dad never showed his emotions in an overt fashion. He was quiet through the episode. I kind of knew what was going to be happening, of course. I don't think he ever had seen an elevator. I'm looking at D elevator right now as a, kind of just to stimulate my mind. He never saw the elevator D going down. I did. And it's a raw emotion when a large, strong building is no longer there, standing as for you to see it visually. I think quiet is probably the first word that comes to my mind. There was a friend of ours who stood beside us. He found us there, and he was stood beside, and he was somewhat quiet too initially, and then he started asking my dad questions, as I remember. And my dad offered him questions. So it was a point, you know, it was almost it was his moment to almost say a worker's prayer, I guess you might say, to the fact that all of this stuff had gone down. Now, he wasn't in the operations of it, but he was in the services related to the putting dust equipment and making things go. And all of that stuff. So that gave him an audience. I think it was Bert Watt, who was her neighbor. Really, really nice, you know, a nice man there. My father really, really liked the guy. And Bert asked him honest questions. My dad gave him honest answers. And that was, it was an opportunity. It was a theater of opportunities to be able to talk like that. There was no bragging. There was no, as I understand, there was just mechanical. Bert was very interested. because my father said, you see up there, that I used to be up there, type of thing, eh? So it was an opportunity to go for a mental ride on my dad's story.
And the physical reactions to the...
Well, there was no tears, if that's or whatever. But it was everybody was far enough away. We didn't have to run from the blast or the smoke or the dust. But I remember we were far back. I think we were Northern Wood Yard, if I'm not mistaken. They wouldn't let people come close, of course. But there was a big crowd because it was both Port Arthur and Fort Wayne people that would have been involved here. Elevator D, I was by myself. Watching this picture, there was some other guy from the news place there too, if I'm not mistaken. But it was like another brick in the wall to let this piece of a building come down, and
it was Pool 6. That was a huge building.
Yes. Yeah,
so what was the? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the earth shook. No.
Oh, well, yeah, because even here, you feel the vibration. It's sonic, you know. I mean, this is like it's how they do geophysical work, or geology people. They put a transmitter and receiver over here, and you bounce it off of whatever's down below, and you find that there's gold down there. And, well, this is, there's a thump that you remember. And in this case, Elevator D didn't, I think it toppled. They had to be careful they didn't hit the tracks. Whereas in the other one, there were sections that blew up differentially, one way or the other, if I'm not mistaken. And then it's meant to rubble the building and without impairing life, high angle demolition.
So when the explosion was over, mm-hmm. and the dust settled, what was the first thing your dad said?
I can't remember. That was long. That was quite a while ago. But
24 years, approximately.
There you go. Thank you for the note. There wasn't really.
Like, there wasn't, oh well, or.
No. There wasn't none of that. Well, okay, that's just another wiener on the barbecue. Yeah. No, it was never that way with my father. No, because he wouldn't have had that expression for sure. I do. But no, it wasn't a matter of fact, okay, let's go to the bar, or let's go, you know, that would, he'd never do that anyway, or casino, or no, you know, I mean, go home. It resonated with him for sure, and he was, I think, probably also thinking about it. He might have been looking for other contemporary workers in the crowd, people that might have also been with that. I don't think we saw anybody. No, there was our neighbor that we chatted with. You know, if I had my images up here, and I've got my pictures someplace here, I won't look for them now, but I don't think there was anybody. A lot of his old compatriots had already passed away. Tremble had died. A few other guys, Swan Anderson, those guys, Dan Blaze, they were all gone. Bamford was busy doing stuff. So, no, I don't think I don't think he talked about any of that.
Good. No, I'm amazed at what you do remember. So I asked the question just in hope that it might stimulate something. One, I wasn't here for that. We were still living in Winnipeg at the time. Mm. But I do recall people talking about gathering. And I guess the one thing that upsets me, maybe because I have a fondness for these old elevators, in spite of their pitfalls, were the people that were toasting it with champagne. Yay, there it goes. You know, there goes the eyesore.
There might have been.
Do you think how your dad might have felt if he was standing beside those people, or how you yourself would have felt?
I think he would have just looked at them. I would have reacted he would have just looked him in the eye and probably said nothing. Body language. He would have just did it this way. And I would have said, oh, Jesus. I'm sure I would have made some snide remark about that, about their inertness to what they were looking at. They were doing that there as a spectacle. I could use all kinds of analogies current. I won't right now because it'll just get nasty quick. But nevertheless, I'm sure was a cohort of those people there. They weren't where we were. So I'm just trying to quickly see if I had that image. Maybe just stop for now and let me just see if I can get those images for you here.
Once again, we had a pause to discuss in what direction we were going. And it seems appropriate this time, since we've had just over an hour of the interview, and the purpose of that this interview has been to take a look at Bill's personal family connection to the grain industry, which he's done a very good job of. And I have suggested that we call an end to today's session, but we still have other areas very important to the grain trade in Thunder Bay that need to be covered, that Bill has a lot of depth and information on. So we'll set up a third interview and move into the transportation side, including obviously the railways, and also the shipping, the lake shipping, out from the port. So I'll say thank you. Any closing remarks, Bill?
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to expand, and you're doing a noble job. Keep it up, and we will be able to fill in as many blanks as we can from a historical perspective.
Great. And I also want to say, in case something happens to me and I'm no longer around to say it, that Bill has a fantastic photo collection, some of which he's drawn from the Thunder Bay Museum for his particular purposes. So just keep in mind that he does have a wealth of photographic information to add depth to our discussions. So thanks again, Bill. We'll meet again.
On the ammo. Here we go.